Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it about our brains that lets us feel happiness? And what can we do to increase the odds of experiencing that most sought emotion? Most of us have goals or desires whose attainment we are almost certain will please us. But as my guest today will explain, our attempts to reach those goals through focused effort can provide us with satisfaction long before we actually achieve whatever it is we've been dreaming about. Shimon Edelman's new book is called The Happiness of Pursuit, What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. He joins us from the studios at Cornell University, where he is professor of psychology. Shimon, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be on here.
So the Founding Fathers did not make happiness a basic right, but they wanted to ensure our right to the pursuit of happiness. What did they innately understand about the nature of human happiness?
I think they understood that it's implausible to be happy all the time. I don't think they gave any evolutionary kind of thought to those ideas, but they definitely had the right intuition. And I think once we realize that happiness, as in fact other emotions, are evolution's means, so to speak, to prod us on in the case of happiness, once we realize that, it's only one step away from realizing that a constant prodding of a draught animal would not do any good to it, to its progress. Mm-hmm. And so things have to go up and down. So we have our ups and our downs, and the pursuit, in fact, is often rewarded and worth for us more than the attainment of the goal, because evolutionarily speaking, animals that venture out and seek the rewards are more likely to succeed. And so that's how those kinds of mental attitudes are rewarded and emerge as dominant.
Is happiness, in fact, a distinctly human characteristic?
I don't think so. I think we share the mechanisms that that make us happy with all sentient beings. I think one, again, falling back onto an evolutionary explanation, this is, of course, a constraint that we share with all the other animals in the ecosphere, that we have to optimize our behavior somehow. And the only means for doing so is to succeed to some extent at anticipating the future, which in turn can only be attained once we learn about the patterns in the environment. And so this knack for foresight, if you wish, or forethought, is something that any animal would really appreciate. And that's the sense in which we share. Just like we share the knack for forethought with all other animals, we also share with them the ability to be, the capacity to be rewarded by processes built into us by evolution.
The metaphor of brain as computer has been in common use for some time now, but the way you see it, the brain isn't metaphorically a computer, it literally is a computer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think one actually can widen this observation and notice that anything and everything that happens in the world implements some computation. You know, the simplest example I can think of is you release, you pick up a pebble and you release it and it falls down, and it follows a particular trajectory. If you time it, you'll see if you do it time and again, it will follow the same trajectory. So the pebble basically, or any other objects that are thrown and basically given over to gravity, they compute their trajectories. A stone that's sitting on the ground computes a very trivial, very uninteresting trajectory, which basically boils down to sitting there doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And so certain systems, certain physical systems, put computation to use, and those are the systems that we call cognitive. Those are the systems that brains can be described as. And so once we, such self-organizing entities figured out how to put computation to use, this kind became the limit, so to speak. In fact, there is a pretty straightforward road from trying to put physics to good use in evading predators in some ecological niche, and building rockets and satellites that get to the sky.
So what makes our ability to use representation in cognition so special?
Again, it's not special in the sense that it's particular to humans. I think all animals can be said to embody representations of their environment, because anything at all that you want to figure out about the environment, which is not present at the moment at which you want to figure it out, needs to be represented somehow, and then the computations would have to deal with those representations rather than with the immediate input. So any kind of cognitive sophistication calls for representation of the environment.
Mm-hmm. And as we evolve the ability to imagine the future, there is, of course, that restlessness, which ultimately makes us productive. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's how I see things. I think I can almost feel it. In fact, the situation that brought about, that prodded me to write things up in the form of this book, is something that I encounter very often when I hike. I get to some nice place, and you'd imagine that I just stay put and enjoy the nice situation, the wonderful vista and so on. Mm-hmm. And yet I feel in those situations as if I'm literally leaning into the future. I'm kind of drawn to move on. And this urge, which of course has been captured by many authors and poets and philosophers, I think it can be understood in terms of predisposition that we have to try to anticipate what's the shape of things to come. And so we experience it at a very visceral level. And this is the cause, the underlying cause, which is a computational cause, really, of our feeling of restlessness.
Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, people have also experienced this idea that if you hike up a mountain and get to the top and look out, that is far more satisfying than if you take some ski lift up and look at the same view for 10 minutes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think here, too, evolution is to blame or to praise, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think to praise, because animals that don't venture out and don't sometimes risk their skin in exploring their environment and just take the easy route and the shortcut, they are less likely to succeed in the long run, this kind of species. And so the most reward we get from actually overcoming some obstacles and difficulties on our way to the summit rather than just taking the easy way.
Talk about this. During much of our waking lives, we are in the present, and yet we are living at least partially in the past or the future.
Yes, some psychologists have described this ability we have metaphorically as a time machine, actually, or time/space machine that mm-hmm. takes us places and to different times. And indeed, studies in which subjects are given, for instance, pagers, and are paged at random moments, and asked, are you right here, right now, or have you been spacing out? Have you been time traveling or space traveling? Very often it comes out that they have been traveling. So there are now studies that quantify this predisposition we have. And it depends on the kind of activity that you're in the middle of. I think, if I'm not mistaken, kind of not surprising, sex is the time when you are the most in the present. And yes, and other activities make you more or less prone to drift away. And I want, though, instead of kind of snickering at this is a very central part of the human condition. Mm-hmm. And I think we can train ourselves to be more in the present. And, of course, this is a very well-known piece of advice, you know, live in the present. Sometimes you see bumper stickers to that effect. It's more human, actually, to drift away occasionally, especially into the future as we anticipate, say, in our next vacation or the next trip to and as I do right now, in a week's time, I will be in Death Valley hiking my spring break.
And is that something you're looking, the hike through Death Valley, is that something you're looking forward to?
Absolutely.
Well, to each his own, I will say. Well, talk about this, though, Shimon. I mean, I guess it can either, depending on what our view of the future is, looking to the future can either give us comfort or it can be frightening.
It can be frightening, but to be afraid and to be afraid of what's coming. Suppose you have some unpleasant thing or some chore that you have to go through or an obstacle to overcome. This, of course, primes you and sets you up for succeeding. If you don't, if you go into some potentially difficult situation without good measure of forethought, you're less likely to succeed. So I think we should see this in the right light as another adaptation. And of course, success, especially success in the face of long odds, is even more pleasurable. So this is the up that would come after maybe a temporary down.
So that ability to plan ahead causes you to bring extra water and really good shoes and a cell phone, things like that, to mm-hmm. make sure that you'll get there.
On a kind of trivial level, yes, but much, much more than that. Over and above the technicalities, my anticipation of the scenery and the feeling of being out there in this absolute peace and quiet of the desert, this is what gives me pleasure right now. And this is a way in which I can use this time machine to my advantage. Something that again has been placed there because it's selected for. This is it's a good quality to have, but of course the reward of having it it being effective and put to good use is what we experience as happiness.
Yeah, so you end up extending your vacation over weeks
uh-huh.
when you might actually only be gone 1 week.
Yep.
So ironically, thinking too much about how to get happy tends to be counterproductive for a lot of people. Why doesn't it work to set happiness as a goal in and of itself?
Again, I think because happiness is... you know, evolution cares about actions and outcomes of actions. Mm-hmm. And so it would be, I mean, one can try to cheat, so to speak, and just to get in the right mood. But the nature of the process and the origin of the process is such that this would indeed be cheating.
Hmm. Talk about the way that we interact, not only with our physical environments, but with the people around us and the way that our brains are affected by all the inputs that come from things we don't have any control over.
Well, we do have some control over our what you call social environment, mm-hmm. Of course, also over the physical environment. I think a fair way to see a human mind is to realize that it does not end at the confines of the skull. So my mind definitely extends beyond the physical limits of my brain. It spills over into the world, into the physical world with which I interact, and also into that part of the physical world, which is the people, the other people whom I know. And this definitely has influence over our actions. We never act, except maybe if you go off into the desert and decide to live alone from that point on. In all other more normal to human society cases, we are, each individual is part of the society. And so... one can, because one succeeds to the extent that one succeeds as a part of society, our happiness is predicated to a considerable extent on others and specifically on the happiness of others. And it's well known, it has been documented now that, in fact, doing good for other people's sake is a better way to attain happiness for oneself than just being selfish and egoistical.
Shimon Edelman is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Cornell University and author of the new book, The Happiness of Pursuit, What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us now. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Psychology Shimon Edelman. He works at Cornell University, and he joins us from studios there. His new book is called The Happiness of Pursuit, What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Shimon, what is the relationship between learning and happiness?
One can see learning as a way of course, the basic function of it is to improve the way in which you deal with the world. But you can also see it as a way of enriching your store of representations of the world, your store of experiences. And given that experience is the lens through which we perceive everything, our own personal experiences, our memories, if you wish, learning becomes can be seen as a tool for enriching our inner life and making our appreciation of the world in all its multifaceted different respects fuller.
I ask this not to be glib, but it does seem that there are some people out there who don't care for learning beyond a certain point. Are they less happy than everybody else?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. In this book specifically, my aim was to bring out certain features of the brain / mind that are human universal. Mm-hmm. And of course, around those universals, there is a very, very wide degree of variation. Different people are made happy by different things. And because it's a balance, it's an interplay of so many different factors. Different people have set points at different levels. And so one can easily imagine that someone would not be happy, would feel restless until they've explored their environment, literally hiking around or cycling around their hometown, and then they start exploring the rest of the planet. And other people are perfectly happy just sitting on their back porch enjoying the view. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever works for you is fine for you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Herschel in Dallas. Hi, Herschel.
Hello.
Hello.
Shimon, hi. Shalom.
Shalom.
I have a couple of references to cite. And when people say they want to be happy, like this famous that says, try to be happy, I think that is totally illogical. John Stuart Mill said, happiness is a byproduct. And that is, by definition, almost. There's no such thing as happiness. It's a totally, amorphous, non-existent. It's a feeling. And the way you get feelings is by doing something. Like, you maybe have heard the prophet, Cahil Gibran, he speaks about urge. Or my favorite philosopher, Bertrand Russell, he talks about curiosity as a natural instinct. And these activities result in some happiness.
What do you think, Shimon?
I cannot agree more. In fact, the view that I offer in the book is that it is activities that make us happy. And so in that sense, yes, happiness is a byproduct. And if you try to, as I already mentioned in this hour, if you try to turn your cognitive abilities just to maximize happiness as an end in its own right, you will probably not succeed very much, because happiness is something that evolutionary processes pay us off for being good at cognition, not for being good at seeking happiness as such.
So as we continue to work and gain knowledge and gain skills, we are better able to put ourselves into this state of flow. What is flow, and why is it the ideal? Why is the ideal balance somewhere between feeling really challenged and feeling really competent?
Yes, flow is a state in which one is not, in fact, thinking about the state one is in. But rather goes with whatever activity one is engaged in. And the activity has to be, this has been extensively studied and documented, the activity has to be challenging to some extent. It cannot be too hard. It cannot be frustrating, but it has to be a bit challenging. And this is I guess one should not see it as a goal, because once you turn it into a goal in its own right, it slips through your hands. But that does, of course, suggest different ways of maximizing your happiness just by engaging in activities that you like, and again, that have to be at least to some extent challenging.
What is the difference between happiness and pleasure or comfort?
I think one can explore the different dimensions of those feelings, and this is indeed what people do. Essentially, think of a large questionnaire with different questions. I mean, we don't really know how to zero in with language onto those feelings, which are essentially computational shortcuts running through our brain. So the only means we have for that is to try to illuminate the issue, the question, from different angles. And the way you do it in psychology is by coming up with as many questions that you think would be related to what you're trying to get at, and then having subjects answer those questions, and then looking for patterns in the answers. And so definitely different kinds of happiness-related emotions emerge from those questionnaire studies. Some have to do with satisfaction in life, kind of a longer range, longer-term feeling. Some have to do with the immediate well-being. Some have to do more with static enjoyment, and some have to do more with action. And I guess that's the best kind of answer one can give here, because the actual feelings exist at such a level that words or linguistic descriptions are not really very appropriate for them, so we can only approximate them. In our verbal labels, such as happiness or joy, are mere approximations for those very complex flowing states on the inside of the brain.
Do you find that certain people are more sensitive to the things that cause happiness than others? In other words, do people have different set points for what they believe makes them happy?
First of all, objectively, it turns out that, yes, different people have different set points. And in fact, if you look at the amount of variation across a population of subjects, population of people, about 50% of that is accounted for by their genetic inheritance. So about 50% in the ups and downs, the swings of happiness or misery that they may experience are predetermined, so to speak, by the interplay of various genetic factors. On top of that, there is a certain percentage that's up to the environment, and then there's enough left over on top of that that is under our control. So even though everyone, of course, has, according to this emerging understanding, a set point for happiness, but on top of that, there is enough elbow room for intervening and trying to improve things. And there are ways of doing that have been also documented.
So I guess all of what you've described accounts for the fact that I think we've all met people who seem to be happy, will profess to be happy, under conditions that most of us would assume would make us permanently miserable, poverty or physical disability or problems that many people think, well, I could not be happy with that.
Yes, the physical environment, and in particular one's degree of poverty or wealth, those factors have effects, but they have different effects on different, for instance, different aspects of happiness that I mentioned earlier. So even though one's wealth has an effect on one's appreciation of life, this longer-term view, it has less of an effect on one's immediate enjoyment of life, one's well-being, which is kind of good news, because it does mean that you definitely don't have to be a millionaire to enjoy life. In fact, there are some quantitative studies in this respect. The annual income over which the degree, the additional income loses its potency in increasing your immediate well-being, It's about $75,000 a year, which is definitely not a small sum, but it's also definitely not $1 million. So mm-hmm. when one says, I feel like $1 million, that one can say to the same extent, I feel like a $75,000.
Yeah, so I guess it's about you know, knowing you can pay the bills and you have what you need, as opposed to mm-hmm. having that yacht that you've always dreamed of.
Yeah, yeah.
So if free will, as you say, is an illusion, why are we so convinced of its existence?
Because if you believe that things are not up to you, you're going basically to cuddle in a corner and wither away, which evolutionarily speaking is not good for your species.
Right. So we need to believe that we have more control than we do over ourselves.
Absolutely, yep.
Mm-hmm. And yet efforts at self-improvement, I should say, feel like free will, and they do seem to have an effect on our happiness.
Mm-hmm. So as I said, there is about 10% of elbow room in this variation of happiness levels that one can actively try to do something about. And this, of course, calls. I mean, there are two ways of looking at that. You can ask why bother at all? Well, we bother because we are human and we have this predisposition to try to improve things. So in a kind of paradoxical fashion, you're not free in the sense that you cannot choose normally, kind of on the average speaking, you cannot choose not to try to be happy. And so once you decide to go for it and see what you can do. There are different things that you can do. For instance, a very concrete example, just count your blessings. And that has been tried in controlled studies, and it turns out that if you do so too often, for instance, if you do so once a day, it's a bit too much. But if you do so maybe twice a week, this has been done specifically with college students, so the particular schedule might not apply to everyone, but... So your well-being improves. So that's in relation to the kind of intervention that is up to you. But I think there's also a deeper question here, which is what I tried to go after in the book, which is what it is that underlies, what are the mechanisms that underlie all all those feelings and the possibilities for intervention. I think that calls for an understanding of the self, which is often left out of the equation. Very many self-help books focus on advice which one should really be suspicious about if one doesn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And to really understand why the advice is good, you have to understand the self.
What does it take to know oneself?
Again, on two levels. On the level of human universals, it really pays to read up about what our brains are and how they give rise to our minds. And then on a more personal level, once you understand the basic nature of those processes, which is they are computational, they try to optimize different aspects of behavior, they have to do with foresight, with this time or space travel into imaginary spaces. Once you understand that, you can turn those conceptual tools, so to speak, onto themselves, onto yourself, and try to understand in your specific case what makes you tick and why things that make you happy or miserable do so.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have a couple of other lines open as well. If you'd like to send email, the address is think@kera.org. We'll go back to the phones now and speak with Scott in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Hi, a very interesting discussion. It sounds, though, a little bit as though happiness is a very individual feeling or attainment. I was wondering what you think, or how does achieving happiness or finding happiness or your conceptions of happiness depend on the cultural setting that you find yourself in? For example, a 17th century pilgrim Puritan versus a 21st century Western secularist, or a 4th century BC Greek, etc.?
Well, one would really have to study those periods that you mentioned very closely to put oneself in the shoes of those people. But the kind of advice that one gleans by going through different sources, secular and religious, and for the religious ones pertaining to different religions, different philosophical sources, they all seem to point to the same small collection of ideas, which I try to summarize and explain in the book, explain why they work, not just because some sage thought up a particular way of being happy or a set of different ways of being happy. So with regard to different cultures, this is definitely true. For instance, the intimate link that ourselves have with the selves of other people who surround us, the nature of those links, even though the interconnectedness as such is a human universal, the function of an individual in a society differs depending on the society. And definitely, if you change places, in fact, as I have done a couple times in my lifetime, if you move, get adopted into a different society, you do have to invest a certain amount of effort in figuring out how things work and how to fit in and optimize things for yourself.
You mentioned earlier in the hour that a lot of people feel happy in doing things for others. Explain why any kind of self-sacrificing behavior would give us so much happiness.
I think this is mostly true for, or maybe even only true for, species that are indeed interdependent. There's a label for this in biology. Such species are called eusocial, so they are social over and above mere, say, communal hunting or interaction with other members of the species. Actually, most of the examples that come to mind are in the insect world, you know, ants and bees. Mm-hmm. And humans, of course, are like that as well. So the more we fit, the better we fit into the society, the better we can understand what makes us tick and how the society in its entirety can attain a level of happiness.
Shimon Edelman is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Cornell University and author of the new book, The Happiness of Pursuit, What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. You can join the conversation over the phone at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Cornell University psychology professor Shimon Edelman is my guest. His new book is called The Happiness of Pursuit, What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Hai who wants to know if you think optimists are happier than pessimists.
I don't know. It's hard for me to put myself in the shoes of a pessimist because I guess I'm an optimist. Mm-hmm. And I count myself as pretty happy. So I think, though, that this particular dimension it just cuts across the different dimensions of human happiness. So a definite scientific answer would be hard to give in this case.
Hmm. What about the phenomenon that people have experienced where they, you know, have experienced something, a loss, and then they think, I did not realize how happy I was before? Is that valid, that sort of idea that we recognize happiness only after we've experienced it?
Experiencing it after the fact is part of this boon that we get from having this simulation, this virtual reality engine, if you wish, mm-hmm. in our heads. And that's perfectly fine. And in fact, that's, of course, as many people have realized, is kind of a way to pull through a difficult period. Even yeah. though some people, some poets have noted that remembering happy times in during times of misery is the worst thing. There's a famous line from Dante. And in fact, the way I see it, yes, if misery, remember Dante referred to that situation with regard to people who are in hell.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, no prospects of things getting any better anytime in the future. But in fact, the very same sentiment about remembering hard times is brought up in the Odyssey, the chapter in which Odysseus, Ulysses, has landed, has been brought back to Ithaca, and is just about, has not yet revealed itself, but is just about to reveal himself to the swineherd, his old servant. The swineherd, Eumaeus, tells him, looking at his pretty sorry appearance, tells him, look, don't be too sorry about the hardships that you had in your life, because you'll later be happier. And in fact, remembering those hard times in your wanderings about around the world, which is exactly the right sentiment. I think that's what we have to realize about the world. And maybe this relates a bit to the question about optimism versus pessimism. Combined with a bit of optimism, remembering happy times during times of hardship is just the right thing for you.
And hard times in times of prosperity can help you recognize how lucky you are in the moment.
Absolutely, yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Bailey in Dallas. Hi, Bailey.
Hi. My question is twofold. The first part is in regard to what makes a person find happiness in another person's misery? And then secondly, how would you go about altering, or, you know, from an external standpoint, how would you help alter that person's perception?
Yes, it appears that unfortunately some people are like that. And, you know, the spectrum of the disorders of the human mind is very wide, and there's no accounting for different ways in which it can get out of whack. And I really don't, I definitely don't have the expertise in, say, clinical psychology to go into this kind of discussion. But so what I wrote about was insofar as insight and understanding can be attained about the run-of-the-mill normal human who doesn't enjoy to see or hear his or her other souls suffering. So it's really hard to tell. I think definitely an intervention is needed. And what kind of intervention? A personal view, not as a scientist, not as a psychologist, just as a human being. I think many such people are beyond recovery. In fact, one can, from the things that are known about the kind of lesions in the brain that one can get, and as a result suffer from different personality disorders, some of those lesions are irreversible, and some of those result in exactly this kind of asocial or antisocial personality. And in that case, of course, it's very hard to think of a remedy. About people that one finds in one encounters in just normal life that are like that, some of them might be beyond help, some might not, but you really have to ask a clinical psychologist for their opinion about this.
Do you believe it's genuinely possible to be happy for another person?
Absolutely. I can speak for myself. I was like that more than once.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my wife is a therapist, and this is her second profession. She had been a school teacher for many years, and then at some point she decided to go and study social work, clinical social work. And we were about 40 when she got her degree, meaning, I was really not young anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the bleachers, in the stadium at Syracuse, where she was down there receiving her degree. And I remember I screamed at the top of my lungs just to express my joy.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally over the top happy for her. And this was absolutely an emotion that I will remember and cherish for the rest of my life.
Yeah, and knowing that it would continue to make her happy must have been a great source of joy for you.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tracy on the line in Dallas. Hey, Tracy.
Hi, I love this topic. And my question is, I have a mother who's been disabled from a stroke for about 7 years, and I've often thought that our society doesn't do a great job in helping these people have a place where they can feel useful anymore. And so I'm curious about what the science says about happiness for people who seem to have no further pursuits in life or who receive a terminal diagnosis, have nothing really to look forward to, supposedly.
Well, this is, again, a kind of an extreme situation which is very hard to relate to, and it would, in fact, I think it would be crass of me to try to put myself in the shoes of a person who is like that. But I think one lesson that we can take home from our understanding of how the mind works is that each of us has this store of experiences that we can fall back upon. And so even in situations in which it's difficult to get about and to pursue further experiences of, you know, the more extreme kind, at least one has this very human, very, very common fallback, which is experiencing your inner world. And of course, we all have access to those wonderful mechanisms that allow space and time travel without physical travel. And by this I mean not just our internal time machine, but reading, this way of getting vicarious experience by immersing yourself in a book or maybe a TV show, and thereby keeping enriching your inner world further.
And I guess we can give ourselves a break for not being able to live in the present all the time. It sounds like what you're saying is that it's not only really natural and normal for us to time travel as we do to better times in the past, maybe better times in the future, but it's essential.
Yes, and I think that someone who trains himself or herself to be exist just in the present, they do themselves a disservice because they disable this very, very basic, very fundamental mechanism that we have of truly, fully experiencing the world. And so one might get contentment in this way, but it detracts from one's humanity, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jay Bean in Carrollton. Hi, Jay Bean.
Hi. The Apostle Paul says in Galatians chapter 5 that the fruit of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, kindness, gentleness, self-control, and they're 9 altogether. And it appears to me that if a person didn't have a relationship with God, he wouldn't have the fruit.
What do you think about that? I don't know how much scientific study has been given to the happiness people get from a relationship with their creator.
Here again, I'm in a situation where I'm hard-pressed to put myself in the shoes of someone like that, mm-hmm. because I see the world naturalistically, and I can tell for myself that the absolute happiness and, in fact, ecstasy that I sometimes experience as a part of my work or my recreation or my being with my family really does not require any appeal to a supernatural force. And I think much of what we read into quotes, such as the one that just has been offered from St. Paul, I think much of that comes from our humanistic predisposition. So we like to read into religious texts what we think and feel is right, which is absolutely the right thing to do. This is, as I said earlier, you find happiness, you know, for you, for yourself. You find happiness where you look for it and where you best know how to find. And so if you have this wonderful characteristics to your spirit that make it resonate to that kind of passage, that's all to the better. And one can find such passages in many different religious and philosophical texts. And I think they all are basically different expressions of our common humanity.
You spoke earlier, Shimon, about how much of our happiness is contingent upon our relationships with other people and with the environment around us. Do we have the power to make other people happy?
Absolutely. Insofar as we are just small parts of this big web of cause and effect, our individual, our respective emotional processes are intertwined, and I'm sure we don't need science to be told that we can make each other happy or miserable by very, very common, very well-known means.
Noting that you mentioned earlier your dislike distrust of many self-help books, we will mention that this is not a self-help book. But I wonder what you say to people who ask you, having studied all of this, what they might do in their lives if they want to experience more happiness.
I think they should go out. They should challenge themselves. They should figure out what it is about their activities and the way they interact with others and with the rest of the world make them happy, and just engage in those kinds of activities, realizing that this is the ultimate tool by which we can change, we can improve our emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. So it starts again with sort of knowing oneself.
Absolutely, yes.
Do you think a lot of people are walking around beating themselves up because they're not happy all the time?
I suspect so. And these people really need to be told that they should relent a bit and just enjoy life more. if you don't look for happiness, it just might find you.
Yeah. Well, we do have this obsession or this sense, particularly, I think, in this country, and maybe that's not your experience, but Americans seem to feel entitled to happiness and damaged if they are not walking around happy all the time.
You know, I was interviewed by the Times of India. I was asked if somehow the perception of us Americans from the outside is that indeed we are obsessed with happiness. And I said, I don't know. I have firsthand experience of other cultures as well. And I think all those cultures are equally, if you wish, obsessed or at least looking out for any even remote possibility of being happy. So this is, I think, a human universal. I think it's just that our founding fathers were very, very good at phrasing this quest.
Shimon Edelman joined us from the studios at Cornell University, where he is professor of psychology. His new book is called The Happiness of Pursuit: What Neuroscience Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Shimon, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure here.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.